Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is going to be a fun one. I got with me the original co-host of Atlanta Business Radio, Miss Amy Otto, and she is now with Virtual Med Staff. Welcome, Amy.
Good morning, Lee. Yeah, it's good to be back. I've missed this. I definitely miss seeing you more often, and wow, I miss seeing a lot of people right now, Lee.
Pretty much everybody, except your family. How has this COVID-19 crisis affected virtual med staff?
Well, we've been busy. We've been very busy. It's interesting. My mom used to always tell her friends I was a pharmaceutical rep, like for years. I've never been a pharmaceutical rep. For 20 years, she's been telling her friends that that's what I do. I was a diagnostic testing specialist for a while. Nope, I was still pharmaceutical rep. Well, she could not grasp what telemedicine was until now. So my mom actually saw her cardiologist via telemedicine, and she's like, can you believe this? I can see the doctor on your sister's iPad. I'm like, yeah, mom, that's what I've been doing. It was kind of comical, but you know, I think a lot of people have not been very quick to embrace telemedicine, and now it's really the only way to be able to flatten the curve, to keep people in their homes and keep people away from the emergency rooms for the basic things, and really try to treat patients virtually. So it's been great for our business, definitely.
Now, let's educate the listener a little bit about telemedicine. Is telemedicine only a visual kind of tool, or can it be just the phone? Because most people, I would think, have some familiarity with like calling a telenurse or calling and getting some kind of basic medical advice. Is this differ kind of dramatically from that?
So there's a lot of different ways telemedicine can be articulated or engaging with the patient. Storm forward is a way, you know, a lot of folks will communicate with their primary care physician via email. And so that is actually one method of telecommunicating with your physician. Sometimes it's just audio. In the case of virtual med staff, it's audio and video. And the reason for that is that a lot of it has to do with the laws and regulations, which have recently been relaxed in a huge way to encourage telemedicine, both on a federal and state level. But really, it could be storing forward. It can be audio only or audio visual. So several different ways to conduct a telemedicine visit.
And then with your firm, you're working primarily with doctor's offices or hospitals or both?
Both. You know, we work primarily with hospitals. However, that has evolved into a big need for outpatient clinic coverage. And our largest client on the outpatient side is for psychiatry with Kaiser Permanente. And now actually reaching patients in their home as well. So using their platform, our doctors can see patients in any of the 50 states. We usually develop a small panel given the region of the hospitals, and there will be several dedicated physicians on a panel to reach those specific hospital systems that are contracted with us. So, yeah, we are actually in 38 states now, and what dictated that has really been the telemedicine laws. There are certain states that just do not reimburse for telemedicine, and certain states that have not embraced parity. So, we have really focused on those that have been looking at telemedicine in a positive aspect and really regulating it for the patient. You know, it's a good thing for the patient to be able to see their doctors. And in rural areas where there's a huge shortage, sometimes it's the only way to see a specialist. So, looking to expand. And this has been great news for the telemedicine industry for sure. A lot of those restrictions and regulations have been relaxed, especially on the federal level. Reimbursement's always been an issue for telemedicine, and now they've added an additional 80 or 90 codes for reimbursement. So that's been wonderful. So Medicare, the federal level, has engaged telemedicine and really put it in a positive light. And then, of course, it goes down to the state level for Medicaid and some of the commercial payers, and that is all state-specific. But even there, I think 48 states have made a statement regarding telemedicine and the expansion of the services, increasing reimbursement, in the use of just the phone, and waiving of co-payments. A lot of positive moves in the area of telemedicine, for sure.
Now, from a patient standpoint, the interaction might be kind of unusual in that they're used to having a human kind of look at them and touch them. How does the doctors kind of handle some of the diagnostic challenges that come with not being, you know, touching them and not being in the same room?
That's a great question. You know, our physicians are actually trained in bedside manner. And what that means is they're trained in how to really try to break through that barrier of the screen. A lot of additional eye contact. Our physicians, we send them two monitors. So they're looking at the patient's chart on one and they're looking at the patient on the other. From the patient standpoint, really all it takes is one time for somebody to engage in that interaction with a physician and really gotten positive feedback across the board. We would think that maybe it's just the younger generation or those in their 20s and 30s that would embrace the technology. But what we found is that even the geriatric population is used to FaceTiming grandchildren and they're used to screens. So believe it or not, patients are embracing it more widely than you may think. And especially for psychiatry, that's one area that we've really grown is in telepsychiatry. And the reality is the doctor doesn't ever touch the patient anyway. And in the small towns, we're finding that a patient would be more apt to seek services from telepsychiatry rather than someone within their small town because they'd be spilling their guts to somebody that they may be sitting next to at their son's football game. Or somebody that they may go to church with. So really the telecommunication aspect of medicine is going to become even wider embraced as the epidemic here continues and people can't get out for prescription refills and they'll be forced to use telemedicine. So it's a great time for our business and a great time for Jackson Healthcare in general. To really showcase how we can live out our values, which is growth, wisdom, and others first. I know Jackson Healthcare has been placing nurses and doctors all over the country to help in the hotspot. And so really giving us an opportunity to shine and to show communities how we can help. So it's been a great time for us.
Now, you mentioned the psychiatry. I would think that that's a kind of an easier barrier because, like you said, they're not usually touching their patients and it's just talking, and it does create a comfort and maybe some anonymity, like you were saying, that they're not driving up and parking their car in front of the psychiatrist's office and maybe their neighbor will see, or you kind of eliminate all of those kind of reasons not to go. Now, are you finding that this has created an uptick in actual people going, or is this something that now that they have access to it, it's maybe too early to tell if this is increasing the number of people who should be getting some help that are actually getting help?
That's an interesting question, too, because I guess we're in, week 5 of COVID-19, and on Fridays, I give my team at Virtual Med Staff an update. So I've had to keep up with the statistics and really trying to encourage individuals to understand how telehealth and the flexibility does help to flatten the curve by keeping people at home. So our psych visits have been way down, Lee, and that's concerning to me because we kind of know what those volumes are, and when we see them lowered, what's going to happen right about now, this week in Georgia, as a matter of fact, is that a lot of folks will be running out of their prescriptions. And it's going to be interesting to see how the mental health afterlash, the backlash of this, because we've actually talked to some psychiatrists in Georgia, our accounts, and they talk about, instead of post-traumatic stress syndrome. Right now, they feel like there's a lot of pre-traumatic stress syndrome. And as the weeks go on and the bills keep coming in and they're unable to be paid and the unemployment rate skyrockets, and as the conditions get worse and worse, those mental health needs are going to increase. So we do anticipate an uptick of psychiatry. We've also seen a reduction in neurology. We do a lot of stroke coverage and general neurology in a lot of emergency departments. I think folks are just really afraid to go. And in some cases, there's designated spots for the COVID-19 patients, and they're outside of the emergency room. But overall, our regular numbers have decreased, but the number of hospitals and clinicians and individuals contacting us saying we need help has increased. I have one large client in Illinois, and they have some of their healthcare workers have COVID-19, so we've had to increase their coverage. So I think as the weeks go on, we're going to hear more and more of that. And it's also kind of stretched our imagination and our ability to provide some other specialties, pulmonology, infectious disease, some of those that, you know, our clients really need right now just to get them through the months of heavy volume for the virus. So definitely has been an exciting time for us. It's allowed us the opportunity to partner with some of our sister companies at Jackson Healthcare and really come together to provide some great resources for our clients and in the communities we serve.
Now, walk me through what it's like if a hospital, maybe they were kind of dabbling with telemedicine before, but they weren't really kind of embracing it and as kind of going all in, and they want to kind of onboard and work with virtual med staff. What does that look like? Do they have to buy a lot of new equipment? Is it really cumbersome to, you know, tie it into their IT and all that stuff? Like, walk me through what it looks like if somebody wants to partner with virtual med staff.
Sure. So depending on the program and whether it's like, obviously stroke has to be a very quick response time, because that window in which you can give a patient TPA is very small to be able to reverse the effect of the stroke. So programs like stroke really do require high definition camera, a microphone. It requires somebody within the hospital system too to be a telepresenter, a nurse that has experience with the telemedicine equipment. But we've seen everything from elaborate robots to very simple homemade systems, which might even include just a laptop on a cart. So really just depends. But we work with whatever they have, because typically our physicians are making their notes directly into the EMR system, which is preferred, you know, so the coordination of care and all the data regarding that patient is in one place. So it definitely helps with the collaborative care model. So we see it again, anything as simple as a laptop or an iPad to something more sophisticated. And with some of these regulations being relaxed, HIPAA has always been a huge issue. And so it used to be that you had to actually have a HIPAA compliant connection, and there were a lot of regulations around that. But more recently, that has been lifted to include Skype and FaceTime. We've already been using Zoom and another product called Video, VIDYO, but a patient can be in their home and could FaceTime their physician. So it's been great having the relaxation of a lot of these laws and regulations. However, we do deem them temporary. So for instance, a client has a need, we find the physician, we can exercise that physician to practice very quickly, given the relaxation of the regulations for licensing. The federal government relaxed the licensing component, so allowing a physician across state lines to practice. So while we would be going ahead and taking advantage of that by placing the physician in this program, side by side, we would go through the normal licensing and credentialing process. So the DEA has lifted a lot of restrictions as well, so that we're able to take advantage of the relaxation of these policies to be able to quickly treat patients in areas of need. So long-winded answer to your question about technology, but it really just depends. It doesn't have to be anything too sophisticated.
And then from the patient side, it just, they probably have the equipment at their house. It might be a smartphone or an iPad in order to communicate exactly. with the physician, right?
Yes, exactly. And for primary care and things that are basic, you know, eye infection, ears, nose, throat, those types of visits are very easy to do via telemedicine. The ones that require actual touching of the patient, it really is important if we're in a hospital environment that we have a liaison, we have somebody on the ground that's taking the computer from patient to patient, and really we help with those workflows as part of our project management just to make sure we're meeting their needs and working as efficiently and effective as possible. But with the more current relaxation of these laws, yes, the patient in their home could use their smartphone.
But like you said, there might be situations where that patient might have to go to a virtual med staff partner, physician group or hospital. And even if they don't have that specialist, they might be able to connect to a specialist elsewhere.
Exactly. Yes. And neurology really has been a big push for us out of need. We had a lot of clients that we were doing telepsychiatry, and I mean, neurologists, there is a huge shortage of neurologists in our country. And so to be able to reach the more rural areas and the rural hospitals, to have a telestroke program or a teleneurology program is huge. You were asking a question about how open-minded are people to telemedicine. I have a group in Nebraska I've been working with for quite some time, and we finally got their contract signed, and the CFO I've been working with has been a huge proponent of telemedicine because she worked in telemedicine at the previous hospital she was at. And everybody's been pushing back. No, this isn't what we want to do. And she was telling me the story that now she's like the hero. She said, I feel like I've got a cape on and I'm at the edge of this cliff and we're all about to jump. And the only thing that's going to save us is this parachute called telemedicine. And I was like, okay, I love that. You know, she's been this big cheerleader for the program, and now people realize the necessity and realize how important it is to be able to expand lines of specialty. And most of all, I mean, the geographic location of you and your family should not dictate the quality of your health care. We've got a lot of farmers in the Midwest and across the United States that work so hard, and the closest facility for healthcare might be an hour and a half away, and the closest area for a specialty might be 4 hours away. So really being able to expand those specialty services is just huge when it comes to quality patient care.
Right. It's one of those things where the technology has been there maybe in education, where you can take a course at an Ivy League school, you know, from a, you know, top instructor in the world, you know, on your laptop, but you couldn't see, you know, the top physician in the world for need, even though you would think that it's a similar activity. Like, it's not that dramatic of a leap to go from a professor teaching a class to a physician kind of giving you information.
Yes. I mean, it's so true. We have seen it in the education system for quite some time, and there's so many benefits. I mean, we see it right now just with the state of our country and everybody having to social distance. This is amazing how people have continued to be able to work from home and conduct their business and still be able to see each other via Zoom or, you know, whatever format they're using. And it's an interesting time right now. And I think the one area that I have probably the greatest concern right now is just the mental health implications. We have started to talk to some larger employers that have on-site clinics, and talking to them about how bringing in, you know, behavioral health will help from a claims perspective and save them money. And you know, the more recent statistics I've been seeing from Mental Health America and the National Alliance on Mental Illness is it's just gut-wrenching to think of the toll that this is going to take on individuals. And, you know, 57.8 million Americans are already living with a mental disorder. They anticipate that'll be up anywhere from 38 to 40% due to the quarantining, and those with small children, even higher warranted diagnosis of trauma-related mental health disorder, because these are trying times. And so we really are preparing ourselves for an uptick in mental health needs via telemedicine. And you know, long after things go back to quasi-normal, I think those mental health implications will still be there. So,
right. Sadly, that's going to be the gift that keeps on giving when this thing's over with. Because, like you said, you can't just, you know, kind of have what I think 16 million unemployed people in the last few weeks and not think there's some mental toll that's taking, and to not have access to care is, you know, you're just making a bad situation worse.
Exactly. And the FQHCs, the smaller federally qualified health centers, they are getting some additional money specifically tagged for telemedicine, which has been huge, because there's, I think maybe 1,400 or more. There's so many patients that rely on these FQHCs for their health care. And there might be more than 1,400, but it's like more than 30 million individuals are seeking their health care at these community health centers. So, you know, we've also been reaching out to them and letting them know that we're here to help. We like to try to help specific companies and clinics to maximize their own resources first, because a psychiatrist is expensive. And so if they have social workers or clinical workers, we help with a workflow. So it's a triage system. We're seeing the patients that are more severe that need to see a psychiatrist or need medication management, and, you know, incorporating their resources that they have internally with the program. So, yes, the mental health needs, I think, are going to far exceed what we're seeing now for sure.
Well, if somebody
wants... The other thing, Lee, is the mental health of these employees. Like, I'm hearing that from hospitals I'm talking to. Our current clients are saying, you know, we're worried about our own employees. I mean, many of them are sleeping in makeshift accommodations at the hospital. And they're working long, long hours in this extremely stressful environment. And, you know, so I think a lot of healthcare workers are really going to need assistance when all this is over.
Right. And people don't realize that the healthcare worker that's out there on the front lines battling, a lot of times they're not even going back to their family because they're kind of quarantined from their own family on top of the work they're doing at the healthcare facility. So there's a lot of pressure on them coming from multiple fronts. So having access to quality kind of mental health care is critical for everybody.
Gosh, exactly. And the Center for Connected Health Policy was recently talking about the funding that's being distributed to FQHCs and to hospitals. I know they've sped up some Medicare payments to certain hospitals just to try to help bridge the gap. But, I mean, Lee, these hospitals are losing millions of dollars daily. It's really sad to see so many of these workers being furloughed, because all of the elective surgeries have been rerouted. I mean, they're not doing elective surgeries. If it's not essential or necessary, they're waiting because of COVID-19. So that's a lot of lost revenue. One hospital up north tell me that it was upwards of $20 million a day.
Wow.
In lost revenue. Yeah. Yeah. So it'll be really interesting to see what the upcoming months hold. And, you know, in the areas where we can help and be of service are those where, you know, patients can either stay in their home or they're going to a clinic, and we might be even substituting for the physician that would typically see the patient that now has been compromised due to the virus, or a family member has been compromised. So the good thing, though, is I do hear a lot of collaboration within the world. Like, a lot of scientists are collaborating. Europe and the U.S. are sharing data on how the virus has been affecting individuals and the antibodies, and they're working towards vaccines. And gosh, over 70 companies are working towards a vaccine. So hopefully something will come up and shake loose, and just be interesting to watch how the problem does unfold.
Well, it must be rewarding to be part of the solution for you to really be able to have a tool that can really help these hospitals and the individuals, you know, help flatten the curve, number one, but also create additional kind of opportunities for these medical facilities to kind of still serve more and more people despite the challenges that are in front of them.
It really has been. It's been a good feeling to be able to reach out to our clients. And more than anything, I've just been listening a lot and being a strategic partner with them. And I always tell them I'm their partner in preparedness, because who knows what tomorrow will bring. And, you know, I've been checking in with my regular clients every Monday, and just to check on them and see, do they need to talk? Do they need additional coverage in an area where we might already have physicians in place, where we can, you know, increase due to the need or demand, or due to, you know, hospital staff either being furloughed or sick. So it's been an exciting time and an interesting time. I've kind of been serving as the liaison for our team, because there's so much information coming at us from so many different sources that you know, some of these fact sheets are 127 pages long.
Right.
Nobody's going to read that. No. So I've been trying to give the Cliff Note versions, and, you know, really relying on some credible resources, you know, the Johns Hopkins tracking, the Worldometer data, and then looking at, you know, for the local, the Georgia Department of Public Health has some great statistics. I just pulled it up this morning, and by county, it looks like there's about 12,550 cases in Georgia, and there's been 442 deaths, with the highest counties being Fulton and Daugherty County. And there's actually been more deaths in Daugherty County, 72, and there have been 50 in Fulton. And I talked to a friend that's intimately involved in some boots on the ground work at in Albany, in Daugherty County, and many of these cases were actually linked back to a funeral where a group of individuals, they were all at the same funeral. So it's just got to practice the social distancing, as painful as it is for some, and just really try to do everything we can to stop the spread.
Yeah, that's one of those things where we really have to be mindful of this importance of staying apart so we can all kind of stay together after this thing's over. But it takes a lot of discipline for a lot of people to kind of say, you know what, I'm going to stay in the house. It might be painful. It might disrupt my normal way of doing things, but that's what's got to be done for at least for the next coming weeks, and if not months, to flatten this curve.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And it is hard. I mean, I'm a social person and I'm a hugger, you know that. And it's been really strange. It feels so awkward to me to be talking to one of my neighbors from across the street, or not petting their dog, or not letting my dog play with other dogs, and you know, having adult kids home now to quarantine with me. It's an interesting time, Lee, but wow, a time where I feel Jackson Healthcare and Virtual Med staff can make a huge difference. And we're just here to listen. We're here to partner. We're here to help. I love talking to individuals about COVID-19 and hearing their perspective and sharing what I know, and, you know, listening and learning, because it truly is a time like, nobody could have ever imagined. And I mean, this is history. This is just unbelievable. And definitely the social distancing and the quarantine is the way to go. So we'll keep on doing it, right, Lee?
Absolutely. Until we get the okay that it's okay, you know, we're on the other side of this. But if somebody wanted to learn more and have a more substantive conversation about virtual med staff, what's the website? I know on the website, I'm sure, has a bunch of material that they can read or listen to or watch to help explain how this works and how they can onboard.
Absolutely. So it's virtualmedstaff.com and lots of links, some information, more recent information on COVID-19. We're publishing white papers as quickly as we can and just gathering information to be able to share and help others learn about what we do. And we're just here to help, whether it's a community health center, a clinic, a hospital, and even, you know, those employers that are looking to really add resources for mental health and primary care even for their employees. So, we would love it if you contacted us. And if you want to know more, visit our website, and my email will probably be on this link as well. Feel free to reach out to me directly.
Good stuff. Well, Amy, thank you so much for sharing your story. You're doing important work and helping lots of people, and we appreciate you.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Lee. Good to talk to you today.
All right. This is Lee Cantor. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.